Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now beginning Exodus chapter 22. I'm going to do the first 15 verses in this audio. I'm going to entitle this Theft, Torts Involving Property, and Bailments. This is legal stuff. It's not exactly the stuff that gives you a hallelujah breakdown or goosebumps. I'm not sure it's going to get you closer to Jesus, but it's part of the inspired Word of God, and I like it because it has to do with law, and I used to be a lawyer, so we're going to wade our way through this, and I'll tell you right up front, it's not going to be the easiest thing in the world. A lot of times, law doesn't seem just to people who look at it. I remember when I was in law school and was confronted with the laws of adverse possession, where somebody can stay on your land for 7 years with certain conditions, and then the land becomes his as against the original true owner. And I would think, that's not fair, that's not just. And then after I studied the issue more closely, I said, that's perfectly fair and that's perfectly just. And then I would present these cases to my friends, to my wife to start with, and to some friends. I said, you think that's fair? And universally, they said, no, that's terrible. The law allows the property to be taken back by the adverse possessor. I said, that's right, and it's perfectly fair. Nobody believes me. Law is complicated. Reminds me of another case that I had a friend of mine who had another friend, and that friend was one of two tortfeasors who had caused some property damage, and he was required to pay back the whole amount because the other tortfeasor was not to be found. And my friend was telling me, this is not fair. It's unjust. I said, no, that's joint and several liability. That's very common, and it's perfectly fair. I didn't go into the reasons why, but it is. So I'll just say right off the front to the layman, a lot of times laws seem unjust. And as we read through here, there will be some laws that might seem unjust. And my goal will be to show you that the law is perfectly just. In fact, it's very sophisticated, actually. And in fact, it anticipates a lot of modern criminal law, tort law, and maybe not contract law right here, but at least criminal law and tort law and property law. And it illustrates something that I've become aware of, is that old law codes is amazing, despite the centuries that have gone by, how much the laws are similar thousands of years ago to the laws today. I guess because people have the same type of transactions, the same type of relationships with one another, the same types of commercial transactions and so forth. All right, well, let me give you the background, the context of where we are in the last portion of chapter 21, our previous chapter, verses 12 through 36. We went over the laws of slavery and of restitution. And now in these first 50 verses of Exodus 22, we're going to look at the laws of theft, the laws concerning theft, and laws concerning torts involving property, and the laws of bailment. So let's get started now with verse 1, Exodus 22. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall pay 5 oxen for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. Now, this verse 1 is concerned with oxen or sheep, which was the main source of wealth for the pastoral Hebrews, as John Gill points out. Gill points out that other animals would be dealt with similarly, of course, because the Hebrew law was based on case law. And so you would look at an example of an ox or sheep being stolen, and you would reason from that case to the case of a stolen donkey or whatever. No law code can handle every possible transaction that human beings can do. The law code would be 5 trillion pages long. So the law gives examples, and then the lawyers and the judges have to reason from those examples to come up with a just solution for the case at hand. So if you had a donkey stolen, you'd have to figure out what the restitution would be, because you're only given 5 oxen for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. You have to somehow come up with a just restitution for a donkey by reasoning. Now, why does the law here mention that the stolen ox or sheep has to be slaughtered or sold to someone else, fenced in other words? Well, because that's a different situation than when the stolen animal is found in the possession of the thief. We'll get to that in the next verse. But here, the thief has slaughtered the animal or sold it. Now, the slaughtering or selling of the animal helps establish the thief's intent to steal. If the ox or sheep were still in his possession when caught, it could have been a mistake. He could say, hey, I didn't mean to steal that sheep. He just wandered into my flock and he got in there by accident. So, but if somebody takes a sheep, he better be darn careful. It's his sheep. He better know who the title is. He needs to be quite sure of the title, because if he eats it, kills it, or sells it, he's going to be liable for some stiff restitution for that thievery. Now, notice they didn't have jails to put the thief into, so the penalty was restitution, not incarceration. Restitution, by the way, is a good thing. It not only makes the person stolen from whole. You see, he's not only made whole, he's actually comes out pretty good. He loses five oxen, but he gets five back. He loses one oxen and gets five back. Of course, he's got to go through the trauma of being stolen from. He's got to go to the courts. He's got to find him a lawyer and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, it's not like it's completely okay to be stolen from, but he does. He gets a good restitution for having undergone the theft. And it's good for the thief because he's not put into a jail where he's going to be homosexually raped and hardened and turned into a more hardened criminal, is what happens almost all the time, it seems to be. And he gets to pay his debt to the person he harmed. So restitution is a good thing. Now let's look at the restitution here in this case. Five oxen and four sheep. Why the difference in restitution of ox and sheep? Well, here's some suggestions. John Gill says an ox is more valuable than a sheep because it's used for plowing. A sheep is not used for plowing, so then therefore, when an oxen is stolen, the loss is greater than when a sheep is stolen, so therefore the restitution is greater. Also, another consideration is that an ox is easier to steal than a sheep, so more deterrence was needed. Well, why is an ox easier to steal? Because sheep are fed in flocks and are easily watched. Sheep like to herd. They don't like to wander around alone, usually, because if they do, they'll die, usually. But oxen are scattered here and there. They're not as much of a herd animal. It's hard for herdsmen to watch them, so they're easier to steal. So therefore, because the ox is more valuable and it's easier to steal and more deterrence is needed, therefore there's more restitution. And so you could use that type of reasoning if it was a donkey that was stolen instead of an ox or a sheep to try to figure out what the restoration ought to be. We go to Exodus 22, verses 2 through 4. If the thief is caught while breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there will be no blood guiltiness on his account. Now, verse 2 assumes a nighttime theft, which is when most crimes occur at night. Verse 3, but if the sun has risen on him, there will be blood guiltiness on his account. He, that's the thief, shall surely make restitution. If he, the thief, owns nothing, then he, the thief, shall be sold for his theft, sold into slavery. Verse 4, if what he stole is actually found alive in his possession, whether an ox or a donkey or sheep, he shall pay double. Let's start with verse 2. The thief caught breaking in, and that would be the fence around the property or in the house, either one. The landowner protects his property, strikes the thief, and the thief dies. Is the landowner guilty? No. No blood guiltiness on his account. Is that fair? It's absolutely fair. Somebody breaks in at night, you don't know what they're going to do. They're stealing your property. They might be willing to getting ready to rape your wife or to kill you. So the risk of being killed is put on the thief if he's going to be a thief at night. And so that's perfectly just. Now let's look at some possible situations that might happen in which the thief dies. Situation number one, the thief comes in and says, don't move. I'm going to kill you. I'm going to steal your oxen. And if you move, I'm going to kill you. Well, let's say the owner somehow gets the jump on the thief and kills the thief instead. Well, it's easy to see that there's no blood guiltiness on the part of the owner for that. That's not a problem. How about this? Let's say the life of the owner's not threatened, but he protects his property by killing the thief. The thief comes in. He's in the act of stealing, of expropriating the oxen, and the owner sees him do it and strikes him from behind and kills him. Well, I don't have any problem with that. That's easy to see. There's no blood guiltiness on the part of the owner. The guy's broken in at night, stealing his property. How does the owner know his life is not at risk? How does the owner know that the thief is not planning after he steals the oxen, he's going to come in and rape his wife and kill him? And remember, at night, there's no neighbors around, nobody around to help you. Here's another situation. Let's say the thief is caught by the owner and the owner has him in custody, and then the owner kills the thief as a matter of revenge, not self-defense now, or not to protect his property, but just as a matter of revenge. Well, I doubt seriously the owner could do that without penalty. I don't think that would fly. I just thought I'd mention some possible situations there. Let's go to verse 3. But if the sun has risen on the thief, there will be blood guiltiness on the thief's account. The thief shall surely make restitution. Now, if the thief was carried out in the daytime, if the theft was carried out in the daytime, as John Gill and Jameson Fawcett and Brown say, this makes it plain that the thief had no intention to kill the homeowner. If you're going to kill somebody, you're not likely going to do it in broad daylight. And so in that case, the owner should let the theft occur rather than killing the thief. It's better to risk the loss of the goods of the owner than the life of the intruder. There's no need to kill him anyway, as John Gill points out. The owner could call neighbors and friends to nail the thief, and that's reasonable. It's the same thing in America, in modern law, too. The homeowner has a lot more rights to protect his property at night than he does in the daytime in almost any jurisdiction. The thief breaks in at night, the owner has no idea that his or his family's lives are safe, but in the daytime, yeah, it's much easier to protect yourself. Now, the restitution in this case, when the thief breaks in and gets caught, is double, but that's only if the stolen goods are actually found alive in the possession of the thief. Remember in verse 1, if the goods, the ox or the donkey, was slaughtered and found dead in the possession of the thief, or whether the thief sold it, the restitution was 4 sheep and 5 oxen. But here, if the animal is still in the possession of the thief, the restitution is double, not 4 or 5-fold, but 2-fold. And again, that's because once the goods are fenced, it's much harder to recover the stolen property. In verse 4, if the thief is caught with the animal right in his property, right in his possession, the owner can get the stolen animal back immediately. He doesn't have to go track the fence down. And of course, if the animal is eaten, well, the owner can't get the animal back instantly. He's got to go through the legal process to get another animal replaced. And so only 2-fold restitution if the animal can be still found alive in the possession of the thief. 4 and 5-fold restitution if the animal has been eaten, slaughtered, or stolen. Another thing to consider, as Jameson Fawcett Brown points out, if the animal has been sold to someone, this is likely a professional thief who is in the habit of stealing and fencing the goods with a professional fence, and therefore we've got to have a stronger penalty against him. And I think that makes a lot of sense. We go now to Exodus 22, verse 5. If a man lets a field or vineyard be grazed bare and lets his animal loose so that it grazes in another man's field, he shall make restitution from the best of his own field and from the best of his own vineyard. The NIV translates this verse this way. If a man grazes his livestock in a field or vineyard and lets them stray, and I think the idea is that he lets his animals loose and they eat all the grass, and so the animals get hungry and they go looking in their neighbor's field for grass. Now, the NESB has bear. The NIV leaves out bear. If a man grazes his livestock in a field, I don't know if that's a translation problem or what, a textual problem, but I think that bear is an incidental detail. It doesn't really matter whether the grass has been grazed bare or not. The point is, if the animal leaves the owner's field or vineyard and then wanders into his neighbor's field or vineyard and starts eating the neighbor's grass, that's where the problem is. So the animal owner should be liable for whatever reason his animal's turned loose, whether his field is grazed bare or whether it's not. And notice that the restitution that has to be given to the neighbor for the animals chomping on his grass or his grapes, the restitution has to come from the best of the owner's field, the best. And that's to keep the restitution being shoddy grain or grapes. He could go and say, yeah, I'll give you what you lost. You had some grapes eaten. Well, here's some of my grapes, and then they're lousy grapes. Nope, not going to get away with that. Now, how much restitution is to be done here is not mentioned. Let me give you some suggestions here. Ellicott says it would just be single restitution. The very fact that the amount is not mentioned makes it sound like it's single restitution. However, I don't think that's a real strong argument, because there's lots of places where the amount of restitution is not mentioned. And also, single restitution doesn't give any incentive to exercise due care. I mean, come on, the man whose animals are grazing, he ought to be able to watch his flocks and keep them from wandering onto his neighbor's property. Could it be double restitution? You could argue that this is the normal amount of restitution in these situations. Exodus 22:4, which is coming up in a minute. It came up last verse. We saw that a thief had to repay double. You say, yeah, but that was thievery. This is just negligent tending of livestock, so why should it be double? So I think the best answer is it's the actual value plus 20%. In other words, 120%. And the reason I say that is because of Numbers 5, verse 7. The person is to confess the sin he has committed. He is to pay full compensation, add a fifth of its value to it, and give it to the individual he has wronged. And that seems to be the general rule for damages. This guy I found on the internet, who is a JD, a lawyer, and a Christian, says concerning this, quote, this is a gentleman named, I think his name was Edward Fudge. His last name was Fudge. He says, quote, the general rule of damages for situations not otherwise covered seems to have been restitution of actual value plus punitive damages of 20%. In other words, 120% restoration. I think if I was a lawyer arguing the case, I'd ask for 120% restitution there, and I think the judge would grant it. We go down to verse 6, Exodus 22. If a fire breaks out and spreads to thorn bushes, so that stacked grain or the standing grain or the field itself is consumed, he who started the fire shall surely make restitution. This reminds me of several incidents. I live out in the country. I let a fire get out of control one day. The wind was just barely blowing. I didn't think it made that much difference. The grass had been fairly cut. I didn't think the grass was that high. And I kept trying to stomp that fire out, and the rain got worse and worse and worse. And I looked at all the woods, and I thought, oh, my gosh, if this fire gets loose, the county's going to make me pay for the whole forest. And that's not the only incident. Fire is serious business if you live in an agricultural situation, as I do. It's serious business. Now, this, of course, is accidental. This is not talking about arson here. If a fire breaks out and spreads to thorn bushes were used often as hedges. And if you've ever seen thorns burn, boy, they're dry and they'll burn like crazy. Here's a verse that shows how they're used as hedges. Micah 7:4. The best of them is like a briar. The most upright is like a thorn hedge. The thorns, of course, will keep animals from going through the barrier. Adam Clark points out that fires are likely to spread because of the dry climate that the Israelites lived in. Another way fire could spread is because often fields were burnt before the autumn rains. If you burn a field, it does things to the ground. It kills bugs. It prepares ground for the next crop. It does a lot of things. Farm people do that today. In the modern age, you'll see them burning their lawns, burning their fields down. I'm not going to do it anymore, but I've seen a lot of people do it. So the person who started the fire shall make restitution. Again, it doesn't say what. I would assume that's 120%, as it says in Numbers 5, verse 7. We go now to Exodus chapter 22, verses 7 through 9. If a man gives his neighbor money or goods to keep for him, and it is stolen from the man's house, if the thief is caught, he shall pay double. If the thief is not caught, then the owner of the house shall appear before the judges to determine whether he laid his hands on his neighbor's property. For every breach of trust, whether it is for ox, for donkey, for sheep, for clothing, or for any lost thing about which one says, this is it, the case of both parties shall come before the judges. He whom the judges condemn shall pay double to his neighbor. Now, this is an example of bailment. Bailment in the law is very simple. If I give you something to keep for me, whether I pay you to do it, whether you pay me to do it, or whether it's done for free, it doesn't matter. That's called a bailment. A bailment is when a person keeps the property of another for a period of time. Now, the person who is the owner of the property is called the bailor, and the person who keeps the bailed property is called the bailee. Now, in verse 7, you have a bailment. Money or goods is kept at the bailee's property, and then that those bailed goods are stolen. The thief is caught. He shall pay double. That's typical, again, assuming that the thief is not fenced or slaughtered the animal, in which case I'm sure he's going to pay four sheep or five oxen. But assuming the goods are still in the thief's possession, he'll pay double. That's not stated, but I think that's reasonable. John Gill points that out. Now we go to verse 8. If the thief is not caught, then the owner of the house shall appear before the judges to determine whether he laid his hands on his neighbor's property. So if his property's stolen, you can't find the thief, well, who's going to be suspect? The bailee. And so the bailee's got to go before the judges and say, hey, he's got to prove I didn't steal the property. If he did steal the property for every breach of trust, that means he stole the property, then the judges will condemn the bailee and make the bailee pay double to the bailor, as it says in verse 9. That's easy enough. Now, this is the case of a bailee who steals property, and that's easy. Nothing is said about a bailee who is negligent and the property is damaged or stolen or lost through his negligence. It also says nothing about whether a bailment in which an accident occurs that is nobody's fault, but just accidents happen and the property is damaged or lost. So we go on to verses 10 through 13, and we'll look at this a little closer. Exodus 22, verses 10 through 13 says this: If a man gives his neighbor a donkey, an ox, a sheep, or any animal to keep for him, and it dies or is hurt or is driven away while no one is looking, an oath before the Lord shall be made by the two of them that he has not laid hands on his neighbor's property, and its owner shall accept it, and he shall not make restitution. But if it is actually stolen from him, he shall make restitution to its owner. If it is all torn to pieces, let him bring it as evidence. He shall not make restitution for what has been torn to pieces. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is one difficult passage here, these four verses, so let's attack it here. First of all, we see in verse 10 that this is a bailment for the benefit of the bailor. If a man gives his neighbor a donkey, an ox, a sheep, or any animal to keep for him, it shows that the bailor is getting the benefit of this. Maybe the bailor needs to go somewhere and needs somebody to look after his animals while he goes on a journey. So he says, okay, will you keep this? Now, the bailment could be gratis, could be for free, or maybe the bailor pays the bailee some money to keep the sheep, but whatever, that doesn't matter. The point is that the bailment was to benefit the bailor. Now, that's important because that distinguishes verses 14 and 15, which we'll take up in a minute. There, those verses are a bailment for the benefit of the bailee, and the rules are different. All right, so here we are with a bailment for the benefit of the bailor. The bailor, first of all, proves that he didn't steal the property. Verse 11, he takes an oath before the Lord. There is no evidence. The thief is gone. Nobody saw it happen, so he doesn't have any evidence, so the law relies on an oath. He takes an oath before the Lord, which is very serious to a Hebrew. I didn't steal it. And the owner shall say, okay, I take your word for it. He has to accept that. And the bailee does not have to make restitution to the bailor. All right, that's easy enough. That's the case of a theft. But now in verse 10, case of a theft with a bailment for the benefit of the bailor. But now in verse 10, we see things that happen that are really not the fault of the bailee. For example, the animal dies. That's not the bailee's fault. So he doesn't have to make restitution for that. If the animal is hurt, he doesn't have to make restitution for that. That makes sense. It's not his fault the animal is hurt. Now, but what happens if the animal is driven away while no one is looking? That means somebody stole it while no one was looking. No restitution in that case, according to verse 11. But verse 12 says, but if the bailed property is actually stolen from the bailee, he has to make restitution. In verse 10, he doesn't have to make restitution. And verse 12, he does have to make restitution in the case of a stolen bailed good. Now, of course, that sounds like an obvious contradiction. Well, here's how John Gill reconciles that. In verse 10, you have a theft when the bailee was not negligent. How do we know he's not negligent? And so, therefore, there's no restitution is because the theft was happened, quote, while no one is looking. Now, it's easy to imagine a theft. Let's say you've got a herdsman looking after sheep, and he goes in to get some water for the sheep, and while his back is turned, somebody steals the good. Well, that's not the fault of the bailee. And thefts are obviously going to occur most of the time when no one is looking. That's what thieves do. They steal when no one's looking, but that can happen when you're not negligent. And besides, this is in a series of things where there is no negligence. If the sheep dies, there's no negligence on the part of the bailee. If the sheep is hurt or the animal is hurt, there's no negligence on the part of the bailee. And likewise, if the animal is driven away and stolen while no one is looking, there's no fault on the part of the bailee, so therefore he does not make restitution in verse 11. But now in verse 12, if it is actually stolen from him, in other words, he's watching it, he saw the thief, he should have done better. He should have stopped it. In that case, he's liable. The bailee must exercise due care to prevent theft. He can't just say to the thief, come on in, take the goods, they're not mine, I don't care. No, he's got to try to protect the bailed property with ordinary due care. Now, it doesn't mean he has to insure the bailed goods and say, well, you know, it wasn't my fault, the thief was stolen, but I'm going to have to pay you for it. No, the law doesn't make. The Hebrew law here does not make the bailee an insurer of the goods. If the theft was done without his negligence, he doesn't have to make restitution. But if the theft was done with the bailee's negligence, in that case, he does have to make restitution to the owner. That's verse 12. Now, verse 13 says, if it is all torn to pieces, the animal, the bailed animal, let him, the bailee, bring it as evidence to the court. The bailee shall not make restitution for what has been torn to pieces. Now, why is that? Well, first of all, the torn animal is proof that the bailee had acted with diligence to protect the property. Somebody's trying to steal it. The bailee tries to stop him. The animal gets killed in the process. And the court's going to say, well, you tried to stop it. You exercised the best you could. Due care. The animal dies. The loss is on the bailor, not on the bailee. That makes sense. All right, now that we've finished with the law of bailments here, let's go back to an incidental detail, verse 11. In order for the bailee to prove that he didn't steal that property, he has to take an oath before the Lord in verse 11. Now, I wonder, you always hear Amish Mennonite types that go around saying, oath-taking is sinful, oath-taking is sinful. Well, they quote Jesus in Sermon on the Mount literally and do that, but there's oaths everywhere in the Bible. This is a serious oath, though. It's not a frivolous oath. This is an oath before the Lord in a legal proceeding. And I'm sure the Amish are objecting to oaths being taken frivolously, as the Pharisees did. Jesus didn't like that either. But a serious oath done in a law court, there's nothing wrong with that. God himself took oaths. He made an oath on himself because he couldn't swear by anything higher, as the book of Hebrews says. We go now to the last two verses I'm going to take up here in this audio, Exodus 22, verses 14 through 15. When a man borrows an animal from his neighbor and it is injured or dies while its owner is not there with it, the man must make full restitution. Verse 13, if its owner is there with it, the man does not have to make restitution. If it was rented, the loss is covered by its rental price. Now, this is another difficult two verses, so let's break them down. First of all, when a man borrows an animal from his neighbor, we see there that the bailment is for the benefit of the bailee because he's borrowing the animal, maybe to use it in his field for whatever reason. But at any rate, we have a bailment for the benefit of the bailee. The animal dies, it injures, and the bailee's got to make full restitution. Now remember, a bailment for the benefit of the bailor, the owner does not have to make full restitution. In the case where the bailor gave his sheep to the bailee so the bailor could go on a religious pilgrimage or something, had to go somewhere, and in verse 10, the animal dies or is hurt, it says in verse 11, the bailee shall not make restitution, doesn't have to make restitution. But here in verse 14, he does have to make full restitution. Why? Because the bailment is for his benefit. And it makes sense to put the risk of loss on the person who's being benefited the most by the bailment. Perfectly reasonable. Now in verse 15, it says, if its owner, the owner of the bailed animal, is there with it. Now this would be the case where the bailee has hired the animal and the owner of the animal to take care of the animal. Let's say he hires somebody to plow his field with an ox. So the owner is there with the bailed ox, and then the ox dies or the ox gets injured. Well, the owner is there, presumably will be able to take care of the animal, so the bailee doesn't have to make restitution. The owner bears the loss. But if the bailee just hires the animal or borrows the animal, and the owner of the animal doesn't come along with the bailment, well, now who's got to take care of the animal? Who's the party that's most able to take care of the animal? That would be the bailee. So if there's an injury, a loss to the animal, the bailee has to make full restitution and bear the loss. But if the bailee hires the owner of the animal to come use the animal and the animal dies or is hurt, well, in that case, the bailee doesn't have to make restitution. He says, I'm sorry, you should have taken care of your animal, and you didn't do it. So the bailor loses. Bailee does not have to make restitution. Now, the last phrase here, if it, the animal, was rented, the loss is covered by its rental price. And this is why I say that these verses refer both to gratis bailments where the bailee bars the animal and a bailment for hire where the animal is rented. The bailed animal is rented. It doesn't make any difference either way. Now, if it was rented, I misspoke here when I said verse 14 was talking about a rented bailment. No, that's not talked about until the end of verse 15. So verse 14 is talking about a bailment for the benefit of the bailee, but it's when the bailee borrows the animal gratis. There's no money paid. But now at verse 15, you were probably talking about a bailment for hire, where the bailed animal comes to the bailee, the owner of the animal, the owner of the baled animal comes to the bailee along with the animal. Now, in that case, the owner doesn't have to make restitution because the bailee is renting the animal, paying money for it. So if the animal dies, the bailor has got his rental money to help cover the loss of the animal. And if he's worried about the loss of the animal, he charges a little bit more to the bailee as an insurance premium to cover the possibility that his animal might be lost. So let's summarize four possible cases here. Let's say the bailee borrows an animal without the owner. He doesn't pay for the animal. He borrows it and the owner does not come along. Well, in that case, the bailee must make full restitution. Let's say in case number two, the man borrows the animal and the owner is there with it. Well, in that case, the bailee does not have to make full restitution. Case number three, a bailment for hire where the animal is not barred but is rented and the owner comes along with the rental. In that case, the bailee does not have to make full restitution. Those cases are clear. Now, what about this? Let's say that the animal is rented and the owner does not come with the rental. It says in verse 15, if the animal was rented, the loss is covered by its rental price, but it's unclear as to whether the owner needs to be there or not. I am assuming that it means that in any case, if the animal is rented, whether the owner comes with the animal or not, the bailee does not have to make restitution for an injured or lost animal. The bailor takes the loss, whether the bailor is with the animal or not. That could be argued, I suppose, but that's what we have lawyers for. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's enough legalese for today in this audio. I know that law is complicated and it might not be very interesting to a lot of people, but we've still got some more. Next audio, we're going to talk about sexual sins. Might be a little bit more interesting than baled oxen. We're going to talk about orphans, usury, and collateral, which actually is a little bit more interesting than baled oxen or sheep. So we'll see you next time. Hope you enjoyed this audio. Hope to see you next time.